Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 23rd, 2003. Today's session is entitled The Leadership We Hunger For, Session 1, Leadership for the Commons, presented for by Dr. Sharon Delaws Parks, number Lens 2003-04. Let's listen in.
Relationships that I have and that Lens has is to be a part of what we call the Associated Learning Partners, which is to bring together folks from our from Lens and then also our universities of the Northwest to talk about how we can coordinate continuing education opportunities. And one of the key persons there is Rick Rouse, who is the head of church relations at Pacific Lutheran University. And Rick was the one who suggested that I call Sharon and ask if she would be willing to come and to join us in this conference. And so I thought, who better to introduce our next speaker, Sharon Delaws Parks, than Rick Rouse. So Rick.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you for the partnership that we share here in the Pacific Northwest with Lens, with Concordia, Trinity, and also our seminaries that serve in theological education. I have just one announcement, and that is to let you know that there is an opportunity for you again to meet Senator Paul Simon, to bring members of your congregation to hear him. There will be two opportunities in November. We're fortunate to have him returning. He'll be at Concordia University in Portland on Monday evening, the 10th of November, and at Pacific Lutheran University on Tuesday evening, the 11th of November. And so if you're in that proximity, we invite you to come and to join with us. You can also check our homepage at PLU Church Relations, and there'll be information on a live video stream, because we'll also be making Paul Simon available live over the internet on Tuesday evening, the 11th. So you can let your congregations know about that opportunity as well. It is my great privilege to introduce our next speaker. Dr. Sharon Delaws Parks came to my attention about 7 years ago when I was speaking with a colleague from Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa. She said, "Rick, we just had one of the most fantastic speakers for a conference." And she said, "If there's any opportunity for you to have her come out to PLU for your summer theological conference, please consider having her come." Well, that's all the encouragement I needed. And I immediately contacted Dr. Parks and discovered that she was just in the process of moving from Boston to Whidbey Island. It was very fortuitous in timing. She did come out for our summer theological conference, and that began now a long-term and very precious relationship that we have with Sharon and with the Whidbey Institute. Pacific Lutheran University has certainly been blessed in many ways by that association, and now we are grateful that she is here to share her gifts with you. Dr. Parks has her roots in the Pacific Northwest, and just a little snippet of her experience here in the Pacific Northwest. She was the associate in ministry to university students at University Presbyterian Church in Seattle in the late 60s, early 70s. And then she was associate chaplain and religion faculty at Whitworth College in Spokane. And then in 1977, she began her teaching career at Harvard University, where she served in a number of capacities, serving over 16 years in faculty and research positions in leadership and ethics in the schools of divinity, business, and the Kennedy School of Government. Dr. Parks has her BA from Whitworth College, her master's from Princeton Theological Seminary, and her PhD from Harvard University. She has received numerous honors and awards. She is prolific in her writing, many articles and publications, including a number of noteworthy books, including co-authoring the book Common Fire, Leading Lives of Commitment in a Complex World. Her book, Big Questions, Worthy Dreams, Mentoring Young Adults in Their Search for Meaning, Purpose, and Faith. And a new publication, a book which will be released in 2004 by the Harvard Business School Press, entitled Can Leadership Be Taught? Dr. Sharon Delos Parks and her husband Larry Parks Delos are associate directors and on the faculty at the Whidbey Institute in Clinton, Washington, where they have served for the past 6.5 years. She currently teaches also in the Executive Leadership Program at Seattle University and serves nationally as a lecturer and consultant for professional groups and organizations, particularly in the area of higher education, religion, and leadership. Please offer a warm welcome for Dr. Sharon Delos Parks.
Thank you very much to Bob for your invitation, to Rick for your introduction and for the colleagueship that we have come to share, and for that first occasion that you invited me to, where I met Diane Shiner, who, when she doesn't live at Holden Village, lives on Whidbey Island, and we're eager for her to come home. It is a deep privilege that you have invited me to share your platform with Senator Paul Simon and with Dr. Cecil Murray. But I want to say that as these hours are moving by, that I am recognizing that it is just as deep a privilege to be with all of you. Because as our conversation begins to emerge in a collective way, clearly there is a level of thoughtfulness and commitment and colleagueship here, individually and collectively, that is to be prized. And we are all privileged to be able to have this time together. I recognize that there are many reasons why you have come to share these days here in this place. And it would seem to me that the primary purpose of our being together is not so much to hear presenters, but it is to, in fact, renew bonds with colleagues, and it is, above all, to share a quality of contemplative time. We are not hearing things that we do not already know. But we are having opportunity to sit together with those things that we know and to ask again, what is it that God is asking of us? What is our vocation? What is our calling? At the Whidbey Institute, we seek to be a place where people can come together and across sectors ask those questions. And not always, but often when we first convene, we ask the question, what time is it? You and I know that we are gathered in a time of profound, dramatic cultural change. It is what we might call, what I'm fond of calling, a hinge point in history. Every time is a time of change. We live in a dynamic universe. But we seem to be among those generations that are asked to live in a time of the profound reorganization of culture and cosmology and imagination and understanding of who we are and where we are. A time such as the Renaissance and Reformation, a time in which Lutherans are supposed to have a heritage of a special practice, a time that people will look back on and they will have a name for. We don't know what our time will be called, but we can guess that when people lived through the Renaissance, they probably did not go around saying, "We're living in a time of new birth." It probably felt chaotic. We know that we are living in hinge time and a kind of cusp time. We know it ecumenically as cultures are meeting and colliding in unprecedented ways on an unprecedented scale. We know it economically as we are all swept up in a global marketplace. And we know it ecologically, as David Suzuki has put it, as for the first time, we are having to ask a question: what are the 6 billion of us doing? And what effect is it having? We know that we are living in a time of extraordinary dieback of species, and that this is caused for the first time by a particular species, our own. We also know that we are the first generations to know if a whole species dies. And we are the first generations to be able to mourn the death of a species. As we all now stand on new moral and ethical frontiers, it is utterly fitting that we have been invited together to contemplate questions of leadership and ethics. As we begin or further our contemplation together, I would like to share an incident, a bit of a story. Some of you may be familiar with the work of Ronald Heifetz. He now teaches at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He teaches a distinctive course in how to learn leadership. And the Lilly Endowment became aware of this work, and they funded there being a thick description and an assessment of that pedagogy, and I was invited to be the person to carry out that work. And by that circumstance, I was in a very crowded amphitheater classroom as the course was getting underway one sparkling September fall morning in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I was up on the top tier, what at the business school is called the sky deck. And I was there because it gave me a great vantage point where I could see both the professor and I could see the students who were overflowing that classroom, as Harvard has a shop-around period, which is great for the students and hell for the faculty because you don't know who's actually going to stay. And as I looked out over the group of students that were gathered there, I saw about two-thirds of the way across a young man who I would guess was 27, 28 years old. He looked bright. He looked pretty savvy. And he looked fully aware that he was in a university with a lot of options. And this course began in a very unconventional way. And I hunched that he was not going to stay. But on the last day of the class, I was still sitting on the top tier, and immediately next to me was this same young man. And in the last 10 minutes of the class period, he was filling out his course evaluation form, and I noticed that he was doing it very earnestly. So, wanting to be a good social scientist, I waited until he was finished. And then as he prepared to leave, I introduced myself and I told him that I had observed him on the opening day and that I had thought that he would not stay. Obviously he had. And had he found the course valuable? He responded immediately that it had been very valuable. And then I said, "Can you tell me why you stayed?" And he responded, "That would be hard to say. Leadership is a word that holds a lot of hungers. Leadership is a word that holds a lot of hungers." We could probably have a long conversation about the many hungers that are held in that word. But I think we have already found evidence here that one of the deep hungers in relationship to leadership in our time is that we hunger for leadership that is committed to the common good. This has emerged when Paul Simon has ruefully referred to the domination of special interests in our political life. It was poignantly expressed when one of you last night raised the question, how do any of us in leadership not sell out? It was in the late 80s, early 90s that with three other colleagues, Larry and Cheryl and Jim Keane, Cheryl grew up in the Lutheran tradition, we recognized that there was a need to understand a quality of citizenship that is critical for the 21st century. Citizenship that is marked by this capacity to not simply care for me and mine, but to care for the common good, the good of the whole. And we were privileged in time to receive a grant from the Lilly Endowment to study over 100 people who can be described in that way. They roughly, in our sample, represent the demographic makeup of our society in terms of their families of origin. They represented people who are overpaid and people who are underpaid. 10% of the sample were born outside the United States. We asked two primary questions, and one of those questions was, in the formation of their lives, how did they become committed to the common good? And the second big question that we were wondering about was, how do they sustain it? We tell that story in the book Common Fire, Leading Lives of Commitment in a Complex World. But one of the things that we have found is that if we are to speak of the common good in a group as thoughtful as this one, for example, that we will not speak very long before someone will say, whose common good? We are immediately suspicious that someone has their notion of the common good that they are prepared to impose on all the rest of us. No, thank you very much. And so we found that it was valuable to look at the image that stands behind the image of the common good, the concept of the common good. And the image is the commons. The commons, by whatever name, is ancient in human experience. We are people who gather to disperse, to gather again. And the places that we gather are the commons. It may be the crossroads of the village. It may be the great plazas of Europe. In the Northwest, it was the longhouse among Native peoples. It might be a cathedral. Among the Puerto Rican community in urban settings, it's the bodega, the little market. In New England, one of the classic forms in our culture, it was that patch of green where everyone could have a cow. And circling that patch of green was what I have come to call an ecology of institutions. There was the church, and there was the schoolhouse, and there was the general store, and there was the sheriff's office with the jail behind, and there was an inn or a tavern, and there was some kind of a communications office, telegraph or newspaper. And there was perhaps a house with docks shingle out in front, and perhaps another place for the justice of the peace. And there was a flock of households in the farmlands beyond. On that green, over time, there was not only a place where you could have cows, but there would often be a memorial, often to people who had died preserving the life of the community. There was often a bandstand. The commons, as we know it in human experience, is a place of memorial and celebration, commerce and communication, play and protest. People met, they talked, they listened, and they worked out how they were going to live together. And they had to do that over and over and over again, partially because there was always change, but also because they always worked it out imperfectly. The Commons is not a nice, sweet, romantic notion. The Commons is a place where we have been who we are. The Commons has always been a mix of sins and graces. In our country, on the Commons in the South, in front of the county seat on market day, slaves were bought and sold. On the Boston Common, Jesuits and Quakers were hanged. We know the Commons also as Tiananmen Square. But the Commons has given to the human species a sense of a shared life within a manageable frame. And within the life of the Commons, there has always been a sensibility that there are some things that are the heritage of all and not to be held in private ownership alone. Most people did not grow up on a New England Commons, and so when I began to sort of back into this notion, I was meeting, I remember, with a group of clergy, and it was a relatively small group of perhaps 20. And so I asked them the question. I said, when you look back on your formative years, and you can make those years as long or short as you wish, I said, when, if ever, would you say that you have experienced a commons? And I remember that the first person who spoke up was a woman who said that she had grown up in North Dakota. And she said everyone lived on the railroad line, and there was the Protestant town and the Catholic town and the Protestant town and the Catholic town. But only one town could have the grain elevator. And that was where everyone went to find out the price of grain, to find out what farmer was sick and needed help, and so on. Others, as we went around the circle, spoke up. For some, it was the church. For some, it was a marketplace. For some, it was the stoops of the brownstones. And then I remember there a man spoke up, and he said, you know, when I was growing up, it was before organized games for kids like Little League, and he said, I think for us it was the playground. And he said, we would go to the playground three generations deep, and we would play ball, and people would talk about the life of the community and so on. There was a man sitting immediately next to him, and he began to nod. And when he spoke, he said, yes. He said, for us, he said, it was also the playground, but he said, when I was growing up, it was beginning to get dangerous. And with quiet pride, he said, us kids created a playground where we could all get there safely. And then he said, and the blacks wouldn't dare come there. And there was silence in the room, as collectively we recognized it had not been a commons. It had been a democracy with exceptions. The image of the commons is always realized imperfectly, but it presses towards inclusion. And the commons, to be a commons, always requires both safety and inclusion. I would like to take a pause now. This will surprise you a little bit, but you'll manage it. And I would like to invite you to reflect for a moment on when, if ever, during your formative years, you had some experience of the commons, a place where people gathered and there was a sense of a shared life within a manageable frame, and where there was some sense of inclusion, even though it may have been imperfectly realized. And now I invite you to take just a few moments and turn to just one person nearby and comment on what you do or don't find coming to mind. I promise to interrupt you. May I interrupt? As you know, at a certain point, I feel left out. So I'm wondering if two or three of you might be willing to share with all of us, just if you would name briefly what was your commons. Yes.
Right. They may not have kids in the high school, they may not have anybody playing for the team, but they're all there and they're all talking to each other.
Okay. Playground, and it draws everyone together big time. Okay? Yes.
I grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where everything was segregated, but the commons was our true district when they had artistic kinds of things for all kids.
Mm. Okay. So art brought black and white together in the Civic Auditorium, and that was the commons. Okay. So art was the heritage and the belonging to the whole community. And art is one of the ways that spirit breaks through in our imaginations. Thank you. Yes, back there. Okay.
Then it didn't matter if they were seven.
Very interesting. Okay. In disaster, the coming together across the tribal boundaries and having a sense of a common life in not so manageable a frame for the moment. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you. I grew up in the context of the church. My father, like Paul Simon's father, was also a minister, and I know that I grew up with a sense of the commons. I remember on communion Sundays when the deacons would be gathered up in front, and as a very young child, having some consciousness that I was watching a banker sitting next to a truck driver and so on. It took me years to notice they were all white and they were all male, and it wasn't a commons in the fullest sense, but it was a reach for a belonging together and some expression of that. I have deep in my heritage a deep indebtedness to the Lutheran community and a deep sense of the heritage of the commons through that. My people were a part of the Scandinavian immigration and came to Homestead in Nebraska. And until relatively recently, I thought this was unusual. I have found out that, in fact, it was a part of a wider ethic that my great-grandfather and grandmother, John and Matilda Anderson, lived in a soddy longer than anyone else in the little community, because my great-grandfather would not build his home other than the soddy until he had built the church, and still would not build his home until he had built the schoolhouse. And it wasn't until I was at Harvard Business School that an aunt got around to telling me that after he had built the church and the schoolhouse and then their home, that he sent to England for better horses, which was the technology of the time, in order that the business of the community could be more productive and more flourishing. He was one who could see the community whole. He could see the whole life of the commons and what it would take for it to flourish. And when Larry and I were driving from Boston to Whidbey Island to move, we happened to be in Chapel, Nebraska on Sunday morning, and we went out and we found the little church, and we found not only the baptismal records of my great aunts and uncles, but we also found and the graves in the graveyard But we also found that on a sparkling new bulletin board with fresh construction paper was the word commitment. And we thought we had just done a pretty snazzy thing writing a book about commitment to the common good. And it put it all in perspective. And you know that you're deeply indebted to those who have carried an imagination of the commons across generations for a very long time. Whatever our particular experience of what we might call a micro commons has been, we all know that we are now swept up in a new commons, a new global commons, global in scope, personal in impact, created by communication, travel, and biotechnologies. This new commons is giving us some consciousness that the commons includes air and seeds and oceans, and it includes the human genome, some things that are the heritage of all. We find ourselves now in a place where we must not only ask, what time is it, but where are we? And as we begin to answer that question, we find ourselves saying, we are in a place that is complex, it is diverse, and it is morally ambiguous. Part of what was so powerful about Senator Paul Simon's presence in our midst is that he stands as a reminder that in today's world, it is probably impossible to be pure, but it may be very possible to be faithful. And so you have chosen as the topic under which we gather, searching for faithful leaders. Searching for faithful leaders. What does faithful leadership in our time, in this place, the new commons, require? As one resource for thinking about that, I would like this morning to draw on the work of Ronald Heifetz, and you might be familiar with his first book, which was titled Leadership Without Easy Answers. His second book, of which there are a few copies available in the bookstore, is titled Leadership on the Line, Staying Alive Through the Dangers of Leading. He makes two useful distinctions that I think are important for us. One of them is a distinction between leadership and authority. In simpler times, we have tended to equate the position of authority and holding positional authority with leadership. He suggests that authority, in fact, is essential to every social group and that it carries out vital functions. Everyone in this room is either in a position of authority or married to someone who is. And we know that if one is in that position, that one is expected to help to provide orientation, a sense of direction, to set norms, to help in conflict resolution, and when necessary, to provide protection. All of those functions help to maintain equilibrium in the social group. They help to maintain equilibrium in the social group. So one of the things we need to recognize is when we ask the questions, why didn't Clinton and why doesn't Bush just come clean when making a mistake? There are many answers to that question, and some were put forth yesterday, but another one is we don't like for our authorities to make mistakes because it is their work to maintain equilibrium in the social group. Leadership, Heifetz suggests, in contrast, and I would say particularly in hinge time, enables a community, a group, or an organization to move from an equilibrium that is no longer adequate, patterns of life and living that no longer adequately work, through disequilibrium that may feel like stress and chaos at times, to a new, more adequate equilibrium, patterns, ways of life by which we can be more adequately faithful in the times in which we are invited to live. The second distinction that he makes corresponds with the first, and he suggests that there is a difference between technical problems and adaptive challenges. And he suggests that a technical problem may be complicated, but it can be responded to with answers already in hand. Adaptive challenges require new learning, even on the part of the leadership or on the part of the authority. Adaptive challenges are recognized when we can see that there is a gap between what we value and what we're actually doing, or when there is a gap between what we are doing and what is actually needed. So the skills and work of leadership is particularly difficult to do if you are in a position of authority. Because in a position of authority, you are to maintain equilibrium, and in a position of leadership, the work is to move from the equilibrium through disequilibrium to another equilibrium. It is also very hard to offer leadership without some measure of authority, formal or informal. We're in a tight spot. Illustrating this, Ron Heifetz has used the example of what happened in the tragedy of September 11th, 2001, when he says that there were two phases of response in terms of leadership. And the first one, he would say, was authority responding in terms of a technical problem. And Giuliani was the right person for the job. He stood there and he reassured New Yorkers and others that we would make our way through the crisis, that the city had the capacity to respond, and he held what was being felt in that moment. We'll always remember he was asked how many had died. If he had said a number, he would have been terribly wrong from what was thought at that point. And instead, he gave that most remarkable answer, "More than we can bear," he said. And so he held the community as the authority, as the mayor in that moment. But what remains is the adaptive work on the other side of responding to the technical problems that were generated by that time. And Heifetz suggests that the adaptive challenges are located in at least three places. He says that one is within the world of Islam, that a religion has been hijacked, as well as airplanes. He suggests that another place is in American foreign policy, that we have adaptive work to do. And then he also suggests that adaptive work is located within the world's religions, particularly those who claim a monopoly on ultimate truth. Who are we called to be at this time in the life of the New Commons? What is the church called to be in the ecology of institutions that hold the life of the commons? What is asked of leadership? I believe that we are asked to address adaptive challenges, those problems that are revealed in a gap between known and the unknown, between known problems and unknown solutions, the gap between our values and our practices. I was talking with Patricia Killen, who some of you may know, professor of religion at Pacific Lutheran University, who has become a colleague and friend, and we were having lunch last week, and I told her I was going to be here with all of you, and I recommend that you have her here with all of you sometime. And we were talking about adaptive challenges, and she was thinking, as she's such a scholar of the history of religion, and particularly here in the Northwest, and she was thinking about Lutherans, and she said, She thought that one way of naming the adaptive challenge that Lutherans now face, not only here but across the country, is how do we take a theological religious heritage that has assumed stability of place, intergenerational community, elders respected, and culture holding wisdom, and make that heritage accessible in a highly mobile society, age segmented by differing cohorts, where elders are warehoused, and the past by many is regarded as useless. And someone just whispered, she's absolutely right on. That person was a Lutheran, so I'm authorized here. The other way that she would put it, and that we would collectively put it, is in this time, in this place, how is the word rightly preached and the sacraments rightly celebrated in the life of our new commons? As our world struggles to make meaning of unprecedented realities, we live in a time when our collective political life is undergoing the experience of a violation, I believe, of word and symbol. That word and symbol seems to be able to mean whatever the market or the electorate will tolerate. I think that one of our vocations in the life of the new commons is that we are called to make present our expertise, our training, our practice in the right use of word and symbol, the right use of word and its juxtaposition with image. We live in an advertising-saturated culture. We all have our favorites in various ways. Our favorites that we think we're attracted to for some reason, and our favorites that we like to critique. My supply is growing of those I like to critique. For a while, I've had this one. This one came out in, I don't know, it's Time or Newsweek, and it came out in the Christmastide season. And it's a beautiful car wrapped up in a big red bow. And under this beautiful silver car, the red bow, it has seven words and a question mark. And the words are, have you been very, very, very good? The smaller print at the bottom of the page, because this was supposed to be enough, but in case you missed the point, it says, whoever said it is better to give than to receive, whoever said it is better to give than to receive, was obviously never on the receiving end of, and it names the car. And then it says three words, each intended to be a full sentence because each is followed by a period. Sleek, sophisticated, powerful. Then it says, what more could you hope for this season? World peace? I mean, I'm willing to wager there was no protest. The commons needs our presence in sorting out and distinguishing God from the idols. The work of theology. I have a second one. This one's newer. You will recognize how new it is because this is for a Hummer. Now, this is a very beautiful page. I know an interior decorator who says you should put yellow in every room. So here it is, beautiful, eye-catching page. It has only 6 words, and they are, need is a very subjective word. This car costs $106,000, as you know. Need is a very subjective word. One of the things I was struck by in Paul Simon's presence with us is how many times he used the word need and what is needed and our response to need. At Harvard Business School, there is a very popular course in which it is taught by a very authoritative professor that there are no needs. There are only wants. Need is defined as whatever you would pay an infinite amount for. And the theory is that there is nothing for which you would pay an infinite amount. Therefore, there are no needs, and once there are only wants and desires, they can be morally infinitely manipulated. Right now, it has been very meaningful to me that in this, our opening hours together, so much has been said and symbolized about water. Part of the argument going on our global commons is the question of whether water is a right, therefore a need, or whether it is a want. And at the bottom of that argument is what's at stake is whether or not it is morally viable to privatize all the fresh water on the planet. And it was said that water is a women's issue. And Larry tells me that the woman who is president of the Bechtel company has said she will not rest until every drop of fresh water on this planet has been privatized. And that stands in profound contrast to Mark's story about living water digging wells of hope. Water is defined as a need by this community. By others, it is being defined as a want. And it was asked whether or not we're in Iraq because of water. And from what I know, Paul Simon got it right when he said no. If he had been asked about oil, I think it might have been different. But I think that it is not always clear to the American public that at a big issue in the struggle between Israeli and Palestinian peoples is water. And where we hear the bulldozers are going over houses, they're also going over the best aquifers. And so if we know something about water as a symbol of life, and I was so moved when in our first worship together, Mark made present the sound of the water. There is something that we have in distinguishing life and death that is needed in the life of the commons. If we were to talk about if we were to identify the central symbols of our faith, there would be several candidates among us if we were picking the central one, but one of them maybe would be water, the water of baptism. I think bread and wine would be on the list. And I think that the cross as it stands behind me and in its so many other forms, would be another primary candidate. How does the cross live in the life of the commons? Several years ago, I was invited to be the resource person for a bishop's conference for the Episcopal Diocese of Chicago. And I arrived there on Saturday night, very late, and I was very weary. And the conference was going to begin on Saturday afternoon, and I knew that there would be a wonderful liturgical opening. And I was asked by my hostess, Bliss Brown, whether or not I wanted to go to church on Sunday morning, and they would be going in time for the church school and then staying for the worship. And I was very, very tired, and I knew that I could meet my Sunday obligation by the service in the afternoon. And then she went on to say that if I stayed home, that Elizabeth, who was 9 years old, would stay with me to be able to prepare my toast and tea. Well, I thought I could prepare my own toast and tea, but they were obviously, as a family, wanting to offer me hospitality. And unfortunately, I was cursed with knowing a lot about faith development and the importance of practice in early life of children going to observe the Sunday observance. And so if I was going to keep Elizabeth from going to church school and church, then I felt it was my moral duty to get up, and I am not a morning person, and go. And so I did, and in my morning fog, we're driving up to the cathedral, and Elizabeth is in fact saying something about something that's on the corner. And it turns out that there's a cross on the corner that she and other children in the church school have made, and it has something to do with the children in Chicago who have been killed by handguns. And so I realize I need to know something about this, and while the rest of the family goes to church school, I make my way to this cross. And it is a simple wooden cross that stands maybe 8 feet high. And it is set in a square platform. And around that platform, a number of things are written. And I was told that the story behind it was that one of the newspapers had begun to just keep a tally of how many children were dying in Chicago because of gunfire. And the bishop's wife had said to a small group of adults, "Can't we do something about this?" And one of those adults was responsible for the church school. And so it had come into his imagination that in that Lenten season, that he and the children could prepare this cross that could be out in a version of the public square. And on the back of the cross was named all of the children who, during that period of time when the count was there, that each of their names were there. And on the front of the cross, the children had taken mirrors and they had cracked them, and then that, like a mosaic, they had filled in the front of the cross with broken mirrors. I went out to the cross and I walked around it, and on one panel it said, "All you who pass by this way, look and see. Is there any sorrow like the sorrow inflicted on me?" Lamentations 1:12. Another panel said, "The ultimate test of a civilization is not the power of its armies nor the size of its gross national product, but the condition of its children. If they flourish, a society deserves to be described as flowering. If they suffer, the society is not flowering." Another one said, "At least children are owed food, clothing, and shelter. If they are corrupted, if they suffer, if they die from abuse or neglect, an atrocity has been committed for which no other achievement can atone." And another panel said, "Today let us pray for the children of the world who are our future and who are at risk." Then there was a line that said, "This cross was built and placed here by the church of the Cathedral Parish in memory of those children who have lost their lives in the city of Chicago, Easter 1994. I looked at the back of the cross, So many names. Samantha, Joseph, Kent, Arthur, Alicia, Charles, Julius, Michael. Surnames we know and don't know. Haight, Gomez, Macon, Hamilton, Carey, Graham, Villa, Buchanan, Brown, Essex. And then I had heard that a man had come and he had sat there, and he was from outside the city of Chicago, but he had seen his surname there. And he had been moved to establish a scholarship fund for children in Chicago who would not otherwise be able to go to college. And with very slow tread, I walked to the front of that cross. I am not so bereft of vanity that I avoid mirrors, but I avoided that one as long as I could. And then I stood there and came to terms with the fact that I do not live in the city of Chicago, but I am complicit in a society in which children are killed daily with guns and by other means. We have something to bring to the life of the commons that can be transforming and can help the commons to flourish. I remind us that an adaptive challenge exists, that when there is a gap between what we say we value and our practice. When I was at Harvard Business School, George Lodge, working with business people, used as metaphor, he said, there is a gap between when we are singing the old hymns and when we are having to practice in new ways. And he was talking about businesses who are still using an ideology of individualism when, in fact, we are living in a more interdependent world. But I invite us to have some reflection on our own hymn singing. And yesterday morning, and I've talked with Mark about this, he and I are colleagues here, and we were singing a song about the cross, and it was Lift High the Cross of Christ. I grew up a Baptist, and I sang my faith before I did anything else with it. And I love singing with people who can sing the great hymns. And I love that tune. And I loved being reminded that not only Baptists and Methodists, but Lutherans can really sing. In that hymn, the cross is cast in the context of language that uses the words captain, soldiers, conquering ranks, all the world, victory and triumph. What time is it? And where are we? It is hinge time, and we are living in a new commons. And as you sang, I stood in silence with Larry, who also wasn't singing. He grew up Unitarian, so you were putting him over the top. He couldn't do it. He and I are now Quakers, but he says Quakers are Unitarians with the courage of their convictions. Quakers also can be bought. There's histories around that, but I stood there and I imagined all of us. I imagine us standing shoulder to shoulder in the new commons with our Muslim, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, and the list could go on, neighbors. And I imagined us standing with our youth, who Paul Simon has reminded us want a religion that is relevant and that doesn't claim a monopoly. And I imagined our practicing the art of leadership in the life of the new commons, and I imagined that maybe we would want to sing something else. Leadership in a time of profound change can be defined as mobilizing people to engage adaptive challenges. Those places where there is a gap between our values and our practice. We live in big gap time. You may remember that in the book of Ezekiel, particularly as it is rendered in the old Elizabethan English, God was seeking one who could provide leadership and looked for one, the job description said, who could stand in the gap. Annie Dillard, reflecting on this passage, remembered for some reason that Thomas Merton wrote, "There is always a temptation to diddle around in the contemplative life making itsy-bitsy statues." Dillard agrees, and she writes, "There is always an enormous temptation in all of life to diddle around making itsy-bitsy friends and meals and journeys for itsy-bitsy years on end. It is so self-conscious and so apparently moral simply to step aside from the gaps where the creeks and the winds pour down saying, 'I never merited this grace,' and then slunk along the rest of your days on the edge of rage. I won't have it. The world is wilder than that in all directions, more dangerous and bitter, more extravagant and bright. We are making hay when we should be making whoopee. We are raising tomatoes when we should be raising Cain or Lazarus." Ezekiel excoriates false prophets as those who have not gone up into the gaps. The gaps are the thing. The gaps are the Spirit's one home. The altitudes and latitudes so dazzlingly spare and clean that the Spirit can discover itself for the first time like a once blinded man unbound. The gaps are the clefts in the rock where you cower to see the back parts of God. They are the fissures between mountains and cells the wind lances through, the icy narrowing fjords splitting the cliffs of mystery. Go up into the gaps. If you can find them, they shift and vanish too. Stalk the gaps. Squeak into a gap in the soil, turn and unlock, more than a maple, a universe. This is how you spend this afternoon and tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon. Spend the afternoon. Thank you. I look forward to continuing our conversation at Fireside tonight. Thanks.